Hello, I'm ISS's Global Head of Research, Georgina Marshall, and welcome to the 2022 season recap podcast of our Bulletin Season Insight series. In this final June edition, we will take a look back at what's transpired during the main Americas, European, and Asia-Pacific AGM seasons in the last few months, taking a look at interesting trends, new developments, and a few key meetings of interest. We'll also highlight some trends in a few markets that are still in season around the world. Let me introduce you to today's presenters. For the Americas, you'll hear from US Research Head Mark Goldstein, Senior Environmental and Social Specialist Enver Fitch, a senior member of our US compensation research team, Chris Scholar, who are all in the US, and also John Vizikas, our Head of Canadian Research in Toronto. Europe will be covered for us today by two first-time Bulletin participants, Mary Punch, who's a senior member of our UK research team, and Jeppe Skov-Andersen, a member of our Nordic research team. So welcome to them both. We will then close today's podcast with Warren Chen, our research head for Asia ex-Japan, who will give us an update from his home base in Singapore on the main Asia seasons so far this year. So with that, we'll start first with Mark Goldstein, our US research head. Welcome, Mark. In recent years, there has been somewhat of a shift in the center of gravity of the shareholder proposal landscape in the US, away from being predominantly on governance topics, and with more proposals now that are explicitly on environmental and social related topics. We know that many investors see material risks if boards fail to provide proper oversight of environmental and social issues. But before we dive into that with Enver, I'm sure shareholder proponents in the US haven't stopped caring about governance issues as well, correct?
No, definitely not, Georgina. And about 40% of the proposals so far this year have been on governance-related topics. But at this point, much of what is realistically achievable on those main governance topics through shareholder proposals has been accomplished, at least in the S&P 500. Most of those companies have annually elected boards and majority vote standards for director elections and have adopted proxy access bylaws. Most large companies with supermajority vote requirements have tried at least once to get rid of them and unfortunately failed. We still see lots of shareholder proposals on topics like written consent, and an independent board chair, but there's simply less consensus among investors on those topics compared to topics like majority voting and board declassification. And when it comes to what's arguably the major governance concern of our time, namely perpetual dual-class capital structures, public shareholders almost by definition have no real leverage at the individual company level.
Yeah, and many smaller US companies have taken steps to reduce their meeting quorum requirement over the past year. Can you give us the background to that?
Sure. Ever since the rules on uninstructed broker voting were changed, which is more than a decade ago now, brokerage firms have only been able to vote discretionarily on what are deemed routine items, which in practice has meant auditor ratification and a handful of other items that are only occasionally on the ballot. So many small companies that aren't in an index and have limited institutional investor ownership have in fact relied on broker voting on auditor ratification just to make quorum. Well, in the past couple of years, several large brokerage firms, including Charles Schwab and TD Ameritrade, have decided to stop the practice of discretionary voting for retail accounts. And that has left some companies scrambling to achieve a quorum set at a majority of outstanding shares. Some companies have had to adjourn their meetings more than once.
So, have some of these companies amended their bylaws to reduce the required quorum?
Yes, exactly. A very few companies have put the quorum reduction to a vote, but most have done it through a bylaw amendment by the board. Both NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange require a minimum quorum level of one-third of outstanding shares. So in most cases, companies have reduced their quorum from a majority of outstanding shares to one-third. But for companies on the over-the-counter market, anything goes. The danger of a lower quorum is that agenda items that are subject to approval by a majority of votes cast, such as say on pay, for example, or an equity plan where the vote is binding, can be approved by a fairly small percentage of outstanding shares. And therefore, if the company anticipates opposition to such a proposal, it could even take steps to suppress turnout, holding the meeting at an inconvenient time, place, et cetera, as long as it gets the minimum required quorum. But that risk, which may be quite remote, has to be balanced against the costs associated with adjourning meetings and soliciting retail shareholders to vote. Now, those costs are not trivial for a microcap company. So when companies have unilaterally reduced their quorum, we have generally not recommended any adverse votes.
Thanks, Mark. On a bulletin call earlier this year, you talked about a couple of proxy contests that Carl Icahn was running, motivated by animal welfare concerns. Can you tell us what ended up happening at those companies?
Yeah, in the end, not very much. At the McDonald's meeting on May 26th, Icahn's nominees received only 1% support. This may have been because investors found the underlying issue motivating Icahn, which was the use of gestation crates for pregnant sows, to be more nuanced than the way Icahn had presented it, or perhaps because investors didn't feel that it justified changes in the boardroom. So seeing that result, Icahn decided not to proceed with his director nominations at Kroger, which had a similar underlying driver. And so that meeting coming up on June 23rd will be non-contested.
And as we finish out the 2022 US proxy season, are there any upcoming meetings that you think clients should have on their radar?
Yes, there are a couple. Activision Blizzard on June 21st is facing a vote no campaign, alleging insufficient board oversight in light of multiple claims of sexual harassment, sexual assault, gender discrimination. Activision shareholders have already voted to approve the company's acquisition by Microsoft, but that deal is not expected to close until sometime next year. So it's not clear whether this is the company's last annual meeting or whether there will be another one in 2023. And Spirit Airlines has postponed its meeting seeking approval of its merger with Frontier from June 10th to June 30th to give the board more time to continue discussions with JetBlue Airways, which has made a competing offer, and with its own shareholders. Although JetBlue has offered a higher price, Spirit has argued that it would be unlikely to receive regulatory approval for a merger, while a Sprint-Frontier combination stands a better chance of being approved.
Thank you, Mark. And now let's turn to Enver Fitch, also in our US research team, for a review of what we saw in terms of environmental and social issues on the ballot for the 2022 proxy season. Enver, welcome. And what were some of the major trends for ENS issues and proposals for this year?
Georgina, 2022 turned out to be another busy and interesting year for environmental and social issues. Through the end of June, we are tracking 531 ENS shareholder proposals filed at U.S. public companies. This exceeds the 416 proposals that were filed at the same time last year. Similar to last year, we saw that companies faced increased pressure to engage with proponents. There were 226 ENS proposals that were withdrawn, slightly up from 198 withdrawals through the end of June last year, and consistent with the overall trend in recent years regarding high rates of withdrawn ENS proposals, due in part because rising support levels for ENS proposals are pressuring companies to come to agreements with proponents. As a result, 274 ENS-related shareholder proposals made it on ballot through June this year, notably higher than the 186 that were on ballot at the same time last year. This increase is also partially due to the lower number of ENS proposals that were allowed to be omitted by the SEC this year. Omitted proposals went down from 73 through June last year to 31 this year. As you may recall, under the SEC's new guidance, proposals that focus on a significant policy issue are not deemed excludable, even if the policy issue is not significant to the company, because the proposal raises issues with a broad societal impact, such that they transcend the ordinary business of the company. Majority-supported ENS proposals kept pace with last year, with 30 proposals getting above 50% shareholder support, compared to 31 at the same time last year. However, average shareholder support for ENS proposals decreased from 35% at this time last year to 26.3% this year. The decrease is likely the result of a number of factors, some of which include the SEC's change in guidance leading to more prescriptive proposals getting on ballots, the change in economic and geopolitical context affecting investor sentiment on ENS-related proposals, and perhaps to some extent, a growing political backlash against ESG causing a change in sentiment among some investors.
Yes, interesting. Quite a few different factors, as you say, going on there, Enver. We know, of course, that climate change is an issue where many investors would like to see better corporate disclosure and actions to back it up. What are some of the trends specific to climate that you've seen there?
Climate change remained a key focus area in the 2022 proxy season. There were 122 shareholder proposals filed on the topic, up from 84 filed through June of last year. After negotiations, more than half of the proposals were withdrawn and 47 proposals got on ballot, almost double the number of climate change proposals that got on ballot last year. Yet, majority support for climate proposals slightly decreased from 11 to 8, and average shareholder support dropped from around 49.5% this time last year to 32% this year. There are also likely several factors acting at the same time that may be behind this drop, such as more proposals on ballot that were prescriptive in nature, some investors seeming to be less supportive of aggressive GHG emission targets in light of today's political and economic context, and a number of companies appearing to take appropriate steps to address climate change related risks. Like 2021, proposals calling for the adoption of GHG emissions reduction targets were the most common climate proposals filed in 2022. However, significantly more of these proposals this year requested inclusion of scope 3 targets. Proposals on this topic that went to a vote received 37.1% shareholder support, a significant drop from 62.1% at this time last year. One of the shareholder campaigns this year focused on financed emissions, in which proponents requested that several large financial institutions and two large insurance companies refrain from financing or underwriting activities that would be inconsistent with the International Energy Agency's net zero by 2050 scenario, essentially calling for an end to the financing or underwriting of new fossil fuel projects. 16 such proposals were filed and 12 went to a vote. The proposals received 20.9% average shareholder support. And this topic got the lowest support levels among climate change related shareholder proposal topics. We also saw continued pressure on board members from some investor groups and nonprofits in cases where the company was not seen to be taking strong enough steps to understand and mitigate its own and the economy's climate risk. There were vote no campaigns at about 20 companies urging shareholders to vote against certain directors for the company's failure to implement plans consistent with limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. To date, no directors received majority votes against based on climate risk related reasons.
Thanks, Enver. And were there any interesting trends in other environmental topics beside those related to climate change?
Yes, the main other environmental topic was related to plastic use and production. 16 proposals were filed on this topic and 8 ended up going to a vote. At Jack in the Box, a board-supported proposal requesting disclosure on efforts to use more sustainable packaging received 95.54% support. And Phillips 66, a proposal asking for a report on the company's efforts to reduce plastic use, got 50.3% support. And the only other environmental proposal that received majority support was at Home Depot, which was asked to report on its efforts to eliminate the deforestation in its supply chain. That proposal received 64.6% support.
And moving to social issues next, we know diversity and racial justice issues have also been key focus areas for many investors. What were some of the trends here that we've seen this year?
Now, last year, we saw a big surge in the filings of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, proposals, largely driven by the focus on racial injustice and inequality that was sparked by the events that unfolded in 2020. We also saw increased support for these proposals, with 7 majority supports and average support reaching close to 40%. In 2022, we saw DEI issues remain on the forefront as a focus area for many investors. 89 shareholder proposals were filed on these topics, making DEI the second most common ENS proposal type after climate. 38 of these were filed by proponents requesting a racial equity or a civil rights audit, more than doubling the amount filed in all of last year. And these proposals were on ballot for the first time in 2021. and have requested companies to explore how all aspects of a business, workforce practices, products, community outreach, and other charitable donations are dealing with racial and or gender equity. Close to half of the proposals were withdrawn. 21 ended up going to a vote. The proposals saw strong support this year with an average shareholder support of 46.8%, significantly up from 30.4% last year, and 8 of the proposals received majority support. A noteworthy trend also is the growth in shareholder proposals seeking report on workforce data beyond disclosure of EEO1 diversity data. A new proposal this year filed at 24 companies asked for more material corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion data. Proponents are interested in seeing quantitative data related to workforce composition, recruitment, retention, and promotion rates by gender, race, and ethnicity in order to be able to assess and compare the effectiveness of the company's DEI programs. Most of these proposals were withdrawn, but the 5 that got on ballot received an average support level of 32.2%. As for EEO1 reporting, proposals seeking such disclosure dramatically declined this year from 44 filed in 2021 to just 6 this year. The decline in this type of request is indicative of the prevalence of EEO1 disclosure now, particularly among S&P 500 companies.
Yeah, thanks, Enver, for that insightful discussion of the E&S related trends this year. There's certainly a lot going on there. Let's now turn to executive compensation in the US and to Chris Scholar. Hello, Chris, and welcome. At this time last year on the similar podcast, we were discussing some of the lowest average say on pay vote support levels in 2021 since the beginning of say on pay. What do the 2022 say on pay vote results look like so far?
The average vote result on say on pay is once again at its lowest level since U.S. companies began having say on pay votes in 2021. Through the end of May for the S&P 500 index, we're seeing an average of only 87% support for this proposal, which is slightly below the average this time last year, which was a little below 90%. Across all indices, we're seeing about a 91% average support rate.
And despite the pandemic affecting nearly all industries in 2020, median CEO pay in the S&P 500 rose over 5% from 2019 then to 13.4 million. Now that most industries have seen a significant financial and stock price rebound from 2020 lows, what did CEO pay look like for financial year 2021 in the S&P 500?
We're still at the tail end of proxy season, so there may be a few more CEO numbers to come that will affect our data, but it appears that 2021 median CEO pay for the S&P 500 may exceed $15 million, which is a little over a 10% increase over last year and would be the most significant year-over-year increase we've seen since 2014. Now, this next point wouldn't significantly affect the median pay value, but interestingly, we've seen a small but noticeable uptick in the number of companies that are granting their CEOs large one-time grants that are often positioned to cover multiple years of equity compensation. So far, we've seen 5 S&P 500 companies pay their CEO over $100 million in 2021. Only 2 of those examples are for newly hired or promoted CEOs at Intel and Amazon. The other 3 represented sizable pay packages to CEOs who are already established in their roles. If you lower that threshold to $50 million, there were 8 additional pay packages in the S&P that fell between $50 and $100 million.
Interesting. So going back to vote results for a moment, last year's proxy season was also a record year for failed say-on-pay votes, as well as the lower average support levels, which meant, of course, that the 2022 proxy season was expected to have a record number of companies being assessed on their responsiveness to a previous failed vote. How did we evaluate responsiveness in 2022?
Failing a say-on-pay vote is still rare, particularly for large-cap companies, yet we had a record number in the S&P 500 in 2021, with 14 companies around this time last year having failed. So far in 2022, 5 of those 14 companies have received over 70% support on their 2022 say-on-pay. A major shareholder concern described in many 2022 company proxy statements, not only for S&P 500 failures, was with pay program changes that were made in response to the pandemic, particularly negative one-time changes that increased executive pay. In these instances, companies who were deemed to be sufficiently responsive and who saw vote results that reflected that had clear disclosure in the proxy statement that the board would refrain from similar actions, barring exceptional circumstances.
And do any high-profile instances stand out in terms of companies not being responsive?
There were a couple notable S&P 500 companies that failed for the second consecutive year. Intel's say-on-pay vote at the 2021 annual meeting failed. Quoted in this year's proxy, many shareholders cited a grant of over $100 million to the newly hired CEO as the primary cause. In response, Intel improved disclosure about the grant, but did not appear to address magnitude concerns, and shareholders responded at this year's annual meeting by again voting down the say-on-pay proposal. Another company that failed for the second consecutive year was Paycom. The CEO at Paycom received a grant valued by us at well over half $1 billion in 2020, which resulted in a majority of votes against both the say-on-pay proposal as well as a director on the compensation committee at the 2021 meeting. Although no directors received a majority of adverse votes at the 2022 annual meeting, the say-on-pay proposal failed once again, as the company did not appear to address shareholder concerns with the program with any meaningful changes or commitments.
Yeah, thanks for all that information, Chris. It seems like it was quite a contentious season for pay at some, at least some large cap US companies this year. Can you give us a summary for companies beyond the S&P 500?
Yeah, for all US companies through May, we've seen 31 say-on-pay proposals fail to receive majority support from shareholders, or about 2.4% of all proposals, which is a small increase over the 27 companies at this time last year. While there are still annual meetings to be held, we look to be on track for the most failed say-on-pay votes in the say-on-pay era for the second consecutive year.
Thanks, Chris. And this is a good place, I think, to bring in John Vizikas for Canada. John, welcome. Compensation is always a big topic in Canada as well. What did you see this year after last year's also record number of failed say-on-pay resolutions in Canada?
Georgina, while we saw fewer companies with pay-for-performance concerns than last year, we did see more companies where CEOs and other executives received very large equity awards. To name a few examples, the CEO at Nuvei Corporation received equity awards valued at over $110 million, while the company's president received over $24 million in equity awards. GFL Environmental's founder CEO received $27 million in options after he received $32 million in options last year. The Galaxy Digital Holdings founder CEO received no compensation. However, the company's board chair received $36 million US dollars in equity awards, and the co-president $22 million, and the CEO $15 million. And the founder CEO at Smart Centers received a $21 million equity award. While such outside equity awards may be more common in the US, they were relatively rare in the Canadian market until this year. It remains to be seen if this pay practice will further proliferate in Canada. One thing the companies I mentioned have in common is that they are either controlled companies or companies where voting power is concentrated in few hands. Often those companies have a dual class share structure with unequal voting rights, which makes it more difficult to gauge shareholder support of these pay practices.
Yes, for sure. And are there any high profile meetings in Canada you want to highlight for our listeners?
Certainly this year's Shopify meeting was of great investor interest. The company became Canada's most valuable company during the pandemic, only then to see its share price drop over 75% since late last year. Nevertheless, it remains one of Canada's largest companies, and at this year's annual meeting, the company asked shareholders to approve the adoption of a founder share, giving the founder CEO 40% voting power for as long as he remains at the company in an official capacity. He also needs to retain only a minimum number of shares, which means that his equity stake in the company can be diluted away while he still retains the 40% voting power. The controversial proposal faced stiff shareholder opposition and only passed the minimum threshold of a majority of disinterested votes cast after the company's second largest shareholder, the largest remaining pre-IPO shareholder other than the founder CEO, supported it. Excluding shares held by the two largest shareholders, who, by the way, exercised their voting power through multiple voting shares, 68% of outside shareholders opposed the creation of the founder share.
Thanks, John. And what about shareholder proposals in Canada? What were the support levels looking like so far this season?
While just like in many other markets, we saw a larger number of climate-related shelter proposals, there were also some non-climate-related shelter proposals that received strong shelter support. At Constellation Software, a shelter proposal requesting the company prepare a report on racial diversity in the workplace received 63% shelter support. At Loblaw Companies, a shelter request for the company to publish annually a summary of its supplier audit results received 34% shareholder support. At Dollarama, a shareholder proposal requesting the company disclose whether it requires its suppliers, including its third-party staffing agencies, to respect the employees' rights to free association and collective bargaining, received 18% shareholder support. On the climate side, Enbridge shareholders requested that the company strengthen its net zero commitment with a science-based net zero target. The shelter proposal received 23% support.
Thanks, John. Let's now move to Europe, where a large majority of companies have held their annual shareholder meetings, and the 2022 proxy season is definitely drawing to an end. I'll welcome Jeppe, a member of our Nordic research team in Stockholm, and Mary Punch, a member of our UK research team in London, into the discussion. First to you, Jeppe, can you give us an overview of the 2022 AGM season across continental European markets? And now we're midway through June.
Thanks, Georgina. And yes, indeed, I can. While the season is coming to an end in most continental European and Eurasian markets, the Russian season is still ongoing, as are seasons in a few southern European countries, namely in Greece, in Cyprus, Malta, and Spain. The same is actually the case for Germany. However, we recently passed a peak in both Poland, the Baltics, and other Eastern European markets, which notably indicates the end of the main seasons in Europe.
Yeah, and let me bring in Mary next for the UK. Mary, welcome. And a season draws to a main season, at least draws to an end for the UK. What would you say have been the dominant trends so far in the UK market?
Hi, Georgina. Well, we've just begun to observe the impact of the Ukraine war on operations and on share prices for many companies. And, you know, naturally, this is going to be a dominant theme for lots of markets. In the UK, another trend we've seen is heightened scrutiny of executive pay, this time in the context of escalating inflation and the cost of living crisis in the UK. And of course, as we've touched on, say, on climate proposals have continued to attract a lot of attention here. And there's been a particular focus on oil and gas companies, on BP and Shell specifically. And plus a recent event in the UK has been the very long awaited government proposal on audit reforms.
Indeed. And have any clear patterns emerged regarding executive remuneration?
Yeah, well, on pay generally, I mean, the strongest paradigm we've seen has been the return of very high near maximum bonuses. And the targets for these bonuses are typically set right in the middle of, you know, very significant COVID-related turmoil back in the spring of 21. And they've been comfortably exceeded as profits have, you know, surged back. And we've seen recovering share prices creating the potential for windfall gains. And that's a possibility that might be consummated next year when the 2020 LTIP cycle, you know, will vest. And speaking of windfall gains in a broader sense, we've seen the UK introducing a 25% windfall tax on energy companies. And we've seen that the return to high pay as well has deepened, you know, the gulf between executives and the workforce across the economy in general. And this is actually reversing a trend we saw before the pandemic, where workers' wages had tended to grow ahead of director pay in the UK.
And are any sectors particularly impacted by this focus on the disparity between executive pay and that of their workforce?
Yeah, well, the very typically low-paying sectors, you know, of retail and hospitality have been the most impacted. And that's naturally because of the high differential between executive pay and that of the general worker in these sectors. You know, to give you an example, the CEO at Next, the retailer, the CEO pay ratio is 245-1, so very high. And at Tesco, it's also high, it's 224-1. And in the UK, we have a living wage campaign. And this has been seeking to implement a wage that workers can live on as opposed to just, you know, the legal minimum wage. And Sainsbury's, the UK supermarket, that has come under the spotlight because it's been targeted by a group of shareholders who've requisitioned a resolution for the next AGM in July. seeking for the company to become accredited by the Living Wage Foundation. And in fact, Sainsbury's already pays a living wage to its direct employees, but that approach isn't applied to contractor staff who would usually be cleaners and security guards. And if they got living wage accreditation, that would extend to this cohort of third-party employees as well. Now, at present, none of its competitors, so none of the four major UK supermarkets, have received living wage accreditation. And so going forward, you know, we're seeing again 1980s levels of inflation, and they're likely to impact executive salaries. And the key point, I suppose, is whether employee salaries will, you know, will they also reflect this level of inflation?
Thanks, Mary. And that, indeed, that focus on CEO to worker pay ratio is very big news in the UK. Let me bring back Yepa into the discussion. Yepa, if you were to summarise the key topics that have characterised the continental European 2022 proxy seasons, what would they be?
Well, while there obviously is a bit of deviation from market to market, I believe that compensation and climate constitute two of the most prevalent topics during the 2022 proxy season. With regards to compensation, we have previously highlighted how companies throughout Europe have seen strong financial performance during 2021, leading to high level of achievement relative to the preset targets in variable remuneration plans. Arguably, such high achievement levels have been putting extra scrutiny on how well companies disclose the associated targets. And it should be mentioned that this is still not market practice in several European markets due to the sensitivity of these targets. Staying within the topic of remuneration, it should be mentioned that 2022 was the first year of mandatory remuneration report votes in Germany and in Norway. For Norway, a key observation was that the board of directors of Norwegian issuers use a significant amount of discretion and assess all performance metrics as a whole, rather than assigning individual weights to each metric used under the variable remuneration element. For Germany, similar trends are evolving, as we have been seeing a lot of companies using discretion to increase payouts and further failing to respond to high dissent on their remuneration policy votes from last year. Also, high base salary increases without a proper explanation, as well as quite vague ex post disclosure, particularly regarding individual targets, have been prevalent for the German market. First results from German AGMs are showing high levels of shareholder dissent on pay as well. For instance, we saw nearly 58% dissent at HelloFresh, 46% dissent at Bilfinger, 40% dissent at Zalando, and 40% dissent at Commerzbank on the company's remuneration votes.
Very interesting. And while we're on the topic of investor dissent, are there any other markets that stood out in that respect?
Yes, I would like to highlight that we in the Netherlands observed the highest level of dissent on a remuneration-related resolution, namely at Philips, where close to 80% of votes were recorded against the approval of the remuneration report. Here, concerns were raised with regard to the supervisory board's decision to adjust the outcomes of the performance assessment of the short-term incentives and long-term incentive awards for unrealized revenues for 2021 due to the component shortages. However, given the company's product recall related to its Respironics business that has had a substantial impact on the company's financials, including its sales and share price performance, questions arose whether this adjustment was considered adequate.
Thanks for your insights on those European compensation trends, Yepa. You also mentioned climate earlier as well. What's been happening on climate-related voting issues in across continental Europe?
Yes, sure. We previously highlighted how the 2021 season was a breakthrough year on management, say, on climate proposals. In 2022, more European companies, particularly within the energy, construction, and financial sectors, have put forward, say, on climate proposals. In Italy, for example, transport infrastructure operator Atlantia received 98% support for its transition plan, which reflected a net zero ambition by 2040 for its scope 1 and 2 emissions, and by 2050 also including its scope 3 emissions. In Norway, all major Equinor, majority owned by the Norwegian state, proposed a climate transition plan that, despite company intention to continue the exploration and production of oil on the Norwegian continental shelf going forward, was approved by the general meeting. In Spain, the first say on climate proposal was seen at oil and gas company Repsol, which received an 83% support. In addition to these management proposals, we saw a number of climate-related shareholder proposals this season. Particularly, the activist shareholder group Follow This, which also in previous years have submitted climate-related proposals at some of the largest oil companies. In 2022, there were filings at aforementioned Equinor and Shell here in our continental European markets, both asking the companies to set Paris-aligned GHG emission reduction targets. What's interesting, and maybe even unexpected to some, is that the overall shareholder support for the resolutions filed by Follow This decreased in 2022 as compared to in 2021, which was recently further described in an orientation letter from the Follow This team.
Thanks, Jeppe. And let me bring Mary back into the climate change discussion. What about climate proposals and maybe specifically the Say on Climate resolutions in the UK?
Yeah, well, in the UK, we've had 13 of the FTSE 100 issuers submitting their Say on Climate resolutions so far this season. And as well as these formal resolutions across sectors and market caps, there have been companies finessing their climate goals, their reduction goals, and seeking accreditation for these goals, typically from the Science-Based Targets Initiative, the SBTI. Now, the SBTI hasn't yet refined its approach for the fossil fuel sectors, and this is highly relevant, of course, because some of the biggest emitters and the most high-profile players are in oil and gas, and they're in mining. And the lack of verification from the SBTI has led several parties to question whether the targets set by such companies are in fact Paris-aligned. You know, the companies have said that they are. And Shell, which was mentioned already, is a case in point because the company states that its reduction targets are congruent with the Paris goals, but other commentators have disputed this. And in May, we had both Shell and BP hold their meetings, and both of them proposed climate resolutions. And with BP, there was around 11.5% dissent on the Say on Climate proposal. And in Shell's case, higher dissent at 21%. And this kind of level of dissent it's a part of a picture of relatively lower support for company climate plans in the UK this proxy season. Like in many cases and across sectors, we've seen dissent in the region of 20%. So it's going to be interesting to receive feedback from investors, you know, on their motivations for opposing this type of proposal this year.
Indeed. And at the top of our discussion, you mentioned the highly anticipated UK government audit reform proposals. Can you briefly elaborate on those?
Yeah. Well, 2018-2019 saw a swathe of investigations and reports on the subject of audit reform in the UK. And three main reviews resulted, and these were the Bryden Review, the Kingman Review, and a report as well from the UK's CMA, that's the Competition and Markets Authority. And all these reviews had recommendations for audit reform. Now, the government response to these recommendations has been delayed, mainly because just the topic of audit reform has been kind of eclipsed under the current regime, under the Boris Johnson regime, which has focused on reducing the regulatory load for companies, which is kind of working in the opposite direction, really. But finally, the government did publish its report in May, and there's a suite of reforms recommended. Notable are the introduction of ARGA, which would be the Audit Reporting and Governance Authority. And this will replace the FRC as a new and more empowered, really, statutory regulator. And another key change is a provision by which FTSE 350 companies will either have to appoint a non-Big Four audit firm or else allocate some of their audit work to a non-Big Four firm. Now, notably, some of the more radical proposals that were kind of proposed in the reviews haven't been pursued. These would include a split of the auditors into their audit and consultancy businesses. Interestingly, though, around the same time as the publication of the report, one of the Big Four, Ernst & Young, announced that it's going to split the audit function from the rest of its business.
Thanks, Mary. And back to you for a minute or two, Jeppe. Are there any specific meetings that you want to highlight from this season in review from continental Europe?
Absolutely. Most of the European markets, in fact, have seen some contentious meetings during 2022, where board accountability and or even failure to approve discharges for directors have taken place. In the Germanic markets, it has been a particularly contentious season with regards to the discharge votes. Notably, we have seen the failure to discharge the boards of Credit Suisse. That was 60% of shareholders rejected the discharge due to a range of risk and control issues revealed by investigations and settlements, which have entailed substantial monetary and reputational costs for the company and, by extension, its shareholders. Relatedly, Swedish telecom giant Ericsson held its AGM at the end of March, at which shareholders representing at least 1/10 of all shares in the company voted against discharge from liability of the board members and the president and CEO for the financial year 2021. In Sweden, discharge from liability is refused if owners of at least 1/10 of the shares vote against the resolution at the general meeting. Such dissent was raised after the company had been under scrutiny by the US Department of Justice and from shareholders for not properly disclosing that its 2019 investigation had found the company that may have paid militant organizations in Iraq.
And you briefly mentioned that the Russian season is still pending. As a result of its invasion of Ukraine, of course, various countries and regions have imposed sanctions on Russia, which has had implications for ISS as well as for many investors and our clients. What are the key elements of the sanction regimes that have had an impact for us?
Well, at a high level, there are two main sanction frameworks relating to the Ukraine situation, which have and will continue to impact ISS services and business operations for our clients. Firstly, or one category of sanctions is applicable to specially designated nationals, or SDNs, in the US and persons or entities subject to an asset freeze by the EU and UK. All dealings involving services to blocked individuals and entities are prohibited. This means that where a blocked individual is proposed for election or re-election to a company's board of directors, ISS will not provide voting recommendations or vote execution services on items related to that individual. It also means that for blocked companies, ISS will not provide proxy research, voting recommendations, or vote execution services relating to meetings being held by blocked companies. The second category of sanctions provide more narrow restrictions on the specific transactions or services involving designated persons or entities and their subsidiaries. With respect to the universe of companies covered by these sanctions, ISS will not provide proxy research, voting recommendations, or voting execution on financing proposals. The situation on sanctioned companies and individuals continues to evolve almost daily, and ISS is working diligently to process and adjust to this challenging situation. Market disclosure of sanctioned individuals is usually not provided as a clean list of names, but rather the names are embedded in long documents, including other information, making the extraction of relevant names of sanctioned individuals a manual process. The foregoing describes ISS course of action on this matter. It's provided for informational purposes, is not intended as legal advice for investors and should not be construed as such. Since sanction regimes have been introduced, we notice that there is a general tendency for sanctioned persons to step down or be removed from the boards where they are present. The sanction prompted the recomposition of several boards in Russia and outside Russia to some extent.
Thanks, Jeppe. And finally, we've previously discussed the divergence in European markets when it comes to board gender diversity and the levels of diversity required, as well as the timelines for any implementation. Are there any signs of convergence during the 2022 season?
Yes. While, for example, Nordic corporate governance codes prescribe increased efforts to ensure gender diversity on company boards, such soft law approaches are likely to soon be overruled by EU-wide regulatory measures. Last week, the European Commission announced that it welcomed the political agreement reached between the European Parliament and the Council on the directive on improving the gender balance among non-executive directors of listed companies proposed by the Commission, or initially actually proposed by the Commission back in 2012. The directive sets a target for EU companies listed on the EU stock exchanges to accelerate the reach of better gender balance. It sets a share of 40% of the underrepresented sex among non-executive directors and 33% among all directors. As such, we should be seeing a convergence in board gender practices across all European markets over the coming years, when, of course, member states will have to transpose the directive into national law.
Thanks, Jeppe. Let me end our European discussion section with a quick question to Mary. Mary, does the UK research team have any predictions for trends in the medium term?
Yeah, well, we're predicting amplified focus on the environmental element, the E in ESG, and also heightened interest in the social component, the S, seems likely to us against, you know, the current backdrop of strife and uncertainty at home in the UK and abroad.
Thank you very much, Mary and Jeppe. And now we'll leave Europe and transition to Asia. On our previous podcast this year, we have focused on some of the major markets in the Asia region, Korea, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand. As many of these markets' proxy seasons are coming or have come to a close, the India proxy season is just about to start heating up. Warren, for today's podcast, let's focus on India and looking forward. First, can you tell us what is the typical schedule for India's proxy season?
Sure. Typically, we have a mini season in July. It usually starts around the second week of July. We'll then get a little break in August with the main season coming in full force, starting the first week of September and lasts until the third week of September. But this year, we are already seeing a substantial increase in the meeting volume in June. So it's kind of difficult to say now, but it looks like there might be a shift in the meeting distribution this year.
So one to watch for sure. What is the overall capital market condition in India at present? And are there any notable meetings that you know of already that we may see coming up in season?
Yeah, so since the setback suffered during the 2019 and early 2020, the India market has been on a course of rapid recovery. So far in 2022, a total of 52 Indian companies raised an all-time high of 1.1 trillion Indian rupees, and that's about 14.3 billion US dollars, through IPOs. The momentum is likely to continue the rest of this year and well into 2023, with more than 50 companies in the pipeline of getting listed to raise an estimated 1.8 billion US dollars. Private equity funds have also been fairly active in the last couple of years. PE funds have continued to prefer buyouts and control deals with a renewed focus on late stage and growth equity investments in listed companies. Upside sharing agreements and management incentives are also gaining momentum. And we have also witnessed the continued use of convertible securities in public and private M&As. In terms of upcoming notable meetings, two large mergers are on the horizon. First one, Sony Pictures Network India and Zee Entertainment announced in December 2021 that they have signed a merger agreement, creating a large media conglomerate to become a major player in India's entertainment industry. Separately, in April 2022, recently, HDFC Limited, a mortgage lender, announced that it will merge with HDFC Bank in a $40 billion US dollar deal, creating a financial services behemoth. And this deal is still in the regulatory approval process, so it is likely to see the light of the day in around 2023.
Thanks, Warren. In terms of the regulatory agenda in India, what are some of the changes that may impact the India market this year?
Yeah, quite a few. So, so related party transactions are something that are quite common in the India market and often cause shareholders some concern. SEBI, or Securities and Exchange Board of India, the market regulator, has revised regulations on related party transactions, which became effective on April 1st, 2022. The new regulation changes the definition of material related party transactions from transactions amounting to 10% of the annual consolidated revenue to either 10 billion Indian rupees, that's about 130 million US dollars, or 10% of the annual consolidated revenue, whichever is lower. And the new regulation also requires additional information to be disclosed. It now requires a lot more details, especially in the cases where companies are providing loans, deposits, guarantees, or financial assistance. The impact of this change is that it will lead to many more related party transactions that will require shareholder approval, especially for large companies such as Reliance Industries or Tata Consultancy Services, just to name a few, where prior to this change, only a few related party transactions from these large companies would have required shareholder approval just because of the high consolidated revenue numbers of these companies. Next, SEBI has also revised the regulation regarding director appointments, which came into effect on January 1st, 2022. Now, companies now are required to seek shareholder approval of new director appointments at the next general meeting or within 3 months from the date of appointment, whichever is earlier. So with companies required to hold special meetings to ratify the board appointments within 3 months, we anticipate to see a higher volume of special meetings. And finally, SEBI made it mandatory for the top 1,000 listed companies by market cap to file business responsibility and sustainability reporting, or BRSR, from 2023 on. Now, SEBI is encouraging companies to start voluntarily filing BRSR this year. BRSR is set to be the single source of sustainability-linked or non-financial information for companies in India, and that will replace the existing business responsibility reporting framework. Under BRSR, the reporting format has been revamped to include quantitative and qualitative information in a standardized format. So while the mandatory reporting will take effect from next financial year, the voluntary reporting commences this year. So it'll be interesting to see the number of companies adopting the voluntary disclosures and to review the quality of the disclosures they will make. Back to you, Georgina.
Thanks, Warren. And that wraps up not only this podcast, but also this year's ISS Bulletin podcast series as well. Thanks to our speakers today, and many thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope that you found this final installment, as well as this year's entire Bulletin podcast series, helpful and informative. A link to all episodes of our 2022 season podcasts is available for download. Please watch your emails for information on future ad hoc webinars and other broadcasts. From all of us at ISS, thanks again for joining us now and throughout season. Goodbye.